It's astounding how many Jack Smiths there are in the United States of America. And you're going to have clients with similar names, even similar birth dates. Keeping track of and managing the various variations of clients' names is a real issue.
If you want to get involved, you're going to be in this thing for 7 years. You're going to be paying assessments and you're going to be working common benefit and you're not going to get any money out of it for 7 years. It's worth it. You're playing with the big boys, but it's difficult.
Welcome to Trial Lawyer View, the podcast dedicated to the fierce yet compassionate lawyers who fight every day for justice in the courtroom. Our guests are top trial lawyers and their firms who share their stories and experiences, offering valuable insights into their journey, as well as expert guests who provide actionable strategies and practical tips for personal injury lawyers looking to optimize their operations, enhance client service, and drive growth in their practices. Trial Lawyer View is brought to you by Synergy. At Synergy, we aren't just a service provider. We are a strategic partner for personal injury law firms, seamlessly integrating with law firms to boost efficiency from day one. Outsourcing cumbersome administrative tasks like lien resolution and Medicare compliance to an expert partner like Synergy enables personal injury firms to focus on what they do best.
Welcome to another episode of Trial Lawyer Review, where I'm joined by Vance Andrus and Cameron Andrus, two powerhouse figures in the mass torts legal landscape. Vance Andrus, a veteran trial attorney with decades of experience, has built an impressive career in the world of mass torts. From serving as national lead co-counsel for several high-profile mass tort litigations, such as Avandia, marketing, sales practices, and products liability litigation, and the Fosamax products liability litigation, Vance's leadership in mass torts is unparalleled. His vast experience and deep understanding of complex litigation have earned him a reputation of one of the top attorneys in the country, garnering numerous accolades, including the Lifetime Achievement Award from America's Top 100 Attorneys and the prestigious AV Preeminent rating from Martindale Hubbell. Joining him is his son, Cameron Andrus, the Mass Torts Department Manager at Roman Balaban & Associates, LLC, who spent 18 years in the legal industry. Having grown up seeing Vance's leadership, Cameron has a unique and valuable perspective on mass torts, blending his extensive experience as a paralegal with a strategic outlook that isn't confined to traditional attorney viewpoints. From his time as a case manager to now as manager handling complex mass torts, Cameron's insights are substantial. Together, Vance and Cameron discuss the intricacies of mass tort litigation, share their personal insights, and provide listeners with critical strategies for success in the ever-evolving mass tort field. Today, we will get expert advice on navigating mass torts, managing complex cases, and understanding the pivotal role of mass torts as part of your practice. Welcome to Trial Lawyer Review. Thank you, Cameron and Vance, for joining me today on the podcast.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us, Jason.
So you guys provided me with a pretty incredible presentation that had an immense amount of information and details about the mass tort practice. And so the idea of this podcast is really to talk about the things that you guys raised in that particular presentation and ask some questions around it. So I want to start out a little bit about just the aggregation mechanics of mass torts, because it's such a different animal. So I've heard it said that class actions are largely dead for torts and MDLs have taken their place. Can you talk about what makes a well-structured MDL effective in terms of litigation and where they also go off the rails these days?
Let me start by saying that when you have a mass incident, I don't want to call it a mass tort, just a mass incident, the absolute existence of that large number of people creates difficulties. It's like different from anything you've seen. And it's a mutual problem for plaintiffs, for defendants, and the courts. Because if you cannot effectively aggregate all of the claims in one place at one time, then you can never resolve them. The plaintiffs obviously have an issue with having multiple suits in multiple jurisdictions with multiple rules of venue and so forth, the defendants actually do too, because they're going to be eaten alive by their own lawyers charging them for thousands of pieces of litigation as opposed to one big piece of litigation. And the courts, the reason the MDLs exist is because the federal courts cannot take, say there's an incident where a pill injures 10,000 people, 10,000 lawsuits would swamp the federal judiciary. So aggregation is a key. Right now, the way it's done is through MDLs. And in some very small instances, there are class actions. For example, if a jet airplane goes down with all the clients, all of the plaintiffs on board, and it kills all of them in one place at one time, then likely that's going to be a class action. But if a company manufactures pills that different plaintiffs will ingest more or fewer or for a longer period of time or have different responses, it's more useful to use a class, an MDL, than it is to use a class action. Cameron, why don't you tell us what your sense is of what makes an effective MDL?
In my mind, it starts with figuring out where all the pieces fit. And I'm sure we're going to get into this, but how are the leadership roles going to be assigned? Who's going to fit where? Who's going to do what? But it's also simply, what is it about the case that drives the reasoning behind it? A great line, if you think about it, you look back at Fight Club and the burnt car, and he talks about, as the insurance adjuster, that it's cheaper to pay the settlements to the victims than it was to make the recall. Well, we see that in real life all the time, over and over and over and over and over, and our industry wouldn't exist if these companies weren't doing that. So what makes an effective MDL is not just the company, it's not just the fact that the thing happened, it's how are we going to manage it? Are we going to do one front? Are we going to do multiple fronts? All of which, again, I know we're going to get into. So, but it starts with preparation from the very beginning, and knowing that this is not, I'm going to jump in and I'm going to be famous and I'm going to make $1 billion. It starts from, I'm going to work through the trenches and get everything that I need.
Along that line, if I could add one additional thought, I've seen two things about what makes an effective MDL. The first one is the federal judge who, remember, the federal judges have to accept the appointment. They do it by phone. It's all private. You never hear about it. But he has to, or she has to, really want to be engaged and come in with an open mind. That doesn't mean that the judge has to always be on the plaintiff's side, but the judge has to have an open mind. And second, the judge has to be sophisticated at the ways to aggregate. For example, an MDL judge who allows multi-plaintiff complaints to be filed, who adopts a master complaint that applies to anyone who files, who allows you to file directly in the MDL, who does not allow unlimited discovery, that MDL judge is going to be very effective. On the other hand, sometimes, especially new MDL judges, don't understand all those tricks, all those methods of aggregation, and those make for inefficient MDLs. The other thing is about going off the rails. There are rare instances when you know it's gone off the rails. The judge doesn't say hello to you when you come in the court, treats you like crap, just doesn't give you any of the relief you need, allows the defense to pick fights that just drain your energy and effort, and you know that eventually that judge has got it out for your case. Usually not you, it feels like you, but it's usually just the case. Now, Cameron, when that happens, when you're faced with a case where an MDL looks like it's going off the roads, what do you do?
In those circumstances, what my firm and firms that I've worked for in the past have done is you go find a state court play. Go to New Jersey, go to Philadelphia, go to California and you open up a state court play. There are some different opinions about that, and you may tread on some toes. So you have two choices. You can either go do it and just damn the torpedoes. I'm going to do this. As Vance taught me growing up, sometimes you don't ask the cop if you can pee in the park. Or you go to your leadership and you say, hey, here's my idea. Let's work together. Let's coordinate this thing together. What we're seeing is in cases like where you see that sort of difference is most recently there have been cases where none of the discovery in the MDL was given to the JCCP and vice versa, where they were just at odds. They both had their own plans. And then you have cases like what we're working on where you try to negotiate deals ahead of time. And obviously all of this is confidential, so I can't discuss too much about which cases I'm talking about here. But you try to discuss deals ahead of time with defense counsel that says, you're going to allow us to have information sharing back and forth. And here's what we're going to give you. We're going to give you a more thorough PFS. We're going to use the same PFS in both the state court and the federal court in order for you to give us this additional discovery in both places without us having to fight each other. Those tend to be the most effective ways of resolving cases quickly and efficiently.
I probably should have asked this first, since MDLs are a different animal, and you sort of alluded to it, Cameron, but can you guys briefly address what it looks like with leadership and how these are organized? Because I think that's an important difference, obviously, between single event and mass tort is the complexity of this litigation.
You know, in a single event, you, the lawyer, are the leader. In a mass tort, there may be tens of thousands of potential clients or victims scattered amongst the 50 states. And not everyone could be a leader. So the MDL determines that it's important that the entire pretrial litigation in all federal courts nationwide take place in one courtroom. And that judge has to pick the leadership. That fight is where we're both at our worst and at our best. You see the egos, you see all the underhanded things that people do to try to move themselves into position, but you also find who the most interested and interesting leaders are. Once that court makes a decision, at that point, the MDL, which means all the cases in federal court, and nowadays they're removing cases to federal court at an exceptionally fast pace, they grab they have people looking in courtrooms, courthouses to grab petitions as soon as they're filed and remove them. That is run by a leader or leaders who are then in charge of everything involved in pretrial discovery up to and potentially including trying a few bellwether cases.
Vance, along the same lines, can you talk about the challenges of managing thousands of clients, discovery battles, and the leadership committee coordination simultaneously? Because that seems like it's a lot.
It is a tremendous amount. You have to have certain touchstones in life, and particularly in mass torts. And the first one is this. The only person who counts is the individual client. Not you, not the court, not your opponents who you love to hate, but you have an obligation to those clients. And so that has to come first and foremost. If you're dealing with thousands of clients, then you have to deal with all the financial aspects of that and having enough staff and enough money to acquire the data and information that you need to support them. You're right about that the double burden of being in the leadership and also taking care of all those responsibilities. What I find is that you have to remove yourself from one of the two. You can't run the office and run the MDL. You have to pick one, and you have to stick with it, and you have to be surrounded by people who you trust and people who you empower. You know, there's no such thing as delegating responsibility. There's only delegating power, and that involves the power to choose to do or not do as you see fit. If you can't do that and delegate that power to your associates, you'll never get ahead, because the ultimate responsibility lies with the lawyers in the firm, and that responsibility cannot be delegated. I hear all the time of lawyers delegating responsibility to people, but not giving them the authority, the power, to do what they need to do to get their jobs done. So for me, the answer was always just stick with one job. Don't try to do two jobs. Cameron, there's some other aspects to the count, to managing 5,000 or more clients at one time.
Yeah, Vance addressed it, and Jason, you kind of said it too. And I've mentioned it previously, and people who know me have heard me say it. It's about my Don Quixote moment of clients aren't inventory, they're populations. They're human beings, they're people. And so you have to keep up with the interaction with them. You have to send them letters on, you know, and they are, while they are all individuals, and while you have to treat them as individuals, you have to remember that you don't have the time, you don't have the staff to tell them what is specifically happening with their case every 3 weeks or a month, right? But what you do have the time for is to write an update email. Write one update email about here's what's happening in the overarching case. And that goes out to everyone. And every client gets a copy of that. And then every 3 months, you have your staff call the client. Miss Susan, how you been? What can we do? Do you have any updates? Has your phone number changed? Has your email changed? How's the family? Spend 10 minutes on the phone with them and just make sure that they know that you're there. That also allows you to prepare the client. Everyone thinks that their case is worth $1 million, right? That is hands down. Everyone thinks that. I don't care if it is you had a minor surgery to correct it and you were out of the hospital in 2 hours, or if you were in the hospital for, you know, 90 days. Everyone thinks that their case is worth at least $1 million. And you have to prepare clients that that's not feasible in these situations. So what I like to do for my clients, at least, is I give them the numbers and I give them the time frames that we're talking about. I don't tell them what I think their case is worth, because in my mind, that's really pretty unethical to tell a client what you think their case is worth, because you really have no idea. A judge could throw you out and you end up with nothing, right? So what I try to tell my clients is, look, if everybody's case was worth $1 million, every 1,000 cases is $1 billion. And a company can only settle for about 5 to 10% of their total corporate value before they go bankrupt. And once they go bankrupt, nobody gets paid. So if there's 20,000 people involved, you're talking about $20 billion. Companies don't have that kind of money. You can't. So you need to lower your expectations from the very beginning, client. And you need to accept that these litigations are going to take us 5 to 10 years to resolve, with 7 years being the average. And that goes for lawyers getting involved in these cases. If you want to get involved, you're going to be in this thing for 7 years. You're going to be paying assessments, and you're going to be working common benefit, and you're not going to get any money out of it for 7 years. Like, it's worth it. You're playing with the big boys, but it's difficult so that communication, that interaction with the client, is going to help you with your client retention, and it's going to help you with making sure that at the end of the day, when you do, and, you know, obviously this is way too early to be talking about this, but at the end of the day, when you get to settlement, your client trusts you and is going to do what you need them to do for their own benefit.
Well, I just wanted to add something to something that you said. I had a very wise friend who told me, this is early on in the computer industry, he said that he was scheduling all of his meetings of his clients. His clients happened to be district attorneys in the state, across the state. And he was doing it by email. And I said, well, no, hardly no one uses email. How can you do that? And he had a very wise phrase. He said, you can't push a rope. You can only pull a rope. So if I can just get my clients, these district attorneys, to grab the rope, I'll pull them up. So I said, well, that's fine, but how do you do that? He said, well, first, I would send them letters with the meeting times and so forth, and that didn't work real good. And so then I wrote to them and I said, from now on, all communications from this office will go out by email. So if you want to know what's going on, call us up and we'll help you get set up on email. And he said, at that point, they all grabbed the rope. That is an example of the kind of things that you can do to help clients help themselves. One last thing about multiple clients is it's astounding how many Jack Smiths there are in the United States of America. And you're going to have clients with similar names, even similar birth dates. Keeping track of and managing the various variations of clients' names is a real issue.
So we started off with this foundational about the structure of this litigation and the challenges with it, which we're just talking about. For law firms that are listening to this podcast or lawyers who are considering getting into mass torts, there's different ways to do it in terms of alliances and whether it's joint ventures, referrals. How do lawyers looking at this space determine which model is right and how do they protect themselves in getting involved in this litigation?
First of all, a lawyer who is interested in potentially getting involved in this litigation has to ask himself this question. Yeah, that's great. Who's going to run the shop when you're gone? Because the vast majority of very successful plaintiff lawyers that I know, it's a cult of personality. It's because of who they are. They're the ones on TV. They're the ones advertising. They're the ones trying the cases. They don't have time to do this. And they think they do, but they don't. That's number one. Number two, the second thing is, I always hear things like, but I'm a real trial lawyer. I'm not a class action lawyer. I'm not a mass tort lawyer. I'm a real trial lawyer. Well, let me tell you something, dude. We're all real trial lawyers. And they got more real trial lawyers than you can shake a stick at. So that attitude about, I want to come in and I want to be treated special because I'm a real lawyer. That will get you nowhere in this business. What will get you somewhere is if you want to start, you have to start by dipping your toe in the water. And do not jump in completely at one time. I've always felt that cases were king. Oh, we talk about aggregating, we talk about, other than class actions where cases are not kings, because it doesn't matter if you're the leader, you represent all the clients. But in MDLs, cases are king. If you don't have cases, you can't play, you can't maximize your recovery for your clients. So if you want to get in, find a reputable assistant or a provider who can help you find cases. That's first.
I have a slightly different opinion on that, Vance. Cases are important to a point. When you start to get too many cases and you can't manage them, and you're letting your clients languish and you're sticking them in a warehouse and not getting their medical records and not getting them on file and not communicating with them, it becomes a detriment to you because ultimately the defense knows that you're doing that too. And they will use that against you ultimately.
I absolutely agree with that. It doesn't change the fact though that to play, you got to have cases. Cameron's exactly right. You can get too many cases. That can be a real problem. The second thing, though, is you need to send those cases to refer those cases to a real mass tort lawyer with a real mass tort firm who knows what they're doing and will treat you with respect, dignity, and honesty. And then from there, you can start to learn the ropes in order to get into this business. Cameron?
I would certainly agree with that. I think that you start by referring and that gets you into a few meetings, right? Now you go to an AAJ, you go to an MTMP and you have somebody that you've been referring cases to who can now introduce you. Ultimately, there's a lot of politics, right? We always want to pretend like everybody's buddy-buddy. And everybody is buddy-buddy until settlement time comes and then you want your money, you know? And I've been fortunate to grow up around and see a lot of the highest level of integrity when it comes to dealing with people. And so for me, while I understand the theory of carry a sword for your enemies and a knife for your friends, I have not had to really participate in that yet because I just refuse to do so. But that is something that's going to happen. And you're going to get mad and it's going to be, you know, oh, I can't believe you did this to me. And, you know, you want to stay in the business, you got to let those things go too. But ultimately, starting, you do the referrals, then you ally with somebody who says, here, I'm going to get you some common benefit work. And then you go do the job that nobody else wants to do. You go do the privilege log. You go do the document review. You go do the, you know, you go take the depositions and take the late night flights and don't see your kids for 3 months at a time. And, you know, my dad, when he was taking his depositions, always brought me back a baseball cap from wherever he was. And that was kind of, I understood, like, you know, and your kids will understand, but that's what you got to do. You got to go out there and you got to show that you are willing to be just the attack dog. And then once you do that and you do that for this one, well, then the next one, they're going to say, hey, I remember, you know, I remember Tommy stood up and he took that job for me. And then the next one, they invite you a little bit higher in the chain. And the one after that, a little bit higher in the chain. And you get four or five torts in and all of a sudden you're on the plaintiff executive committee or you're actually in a leadership role. And that's the way to really advance yourself through the steps of referral, alliance, joint venture, controlling one yourself.
Well, since we're talking about alliances, collaboration, Vance, I thought it would be good to talk about the leadership roles, and because you've been in that and I think you likened it to being a general in battle. And I'm wondering what leadership lessons you've taken away from steering clients through litigation like Avandia, and you know, what should lawyers understand about that kind of role?
I guess the I have an observation that there are three types of leaders I've seen in the MDL arena. The first one, the one I favor and the one that I believe in, is that your job as a leader is to organize, make sure your troops have all of the men and material and women they need to fight the battles, and then to help create or design the battle plan that we're going to put into place. Of course, Cameron loves to say the first casualty of battle is the plan. But you have delegated authority or power to people and you trust them. That's one type of leader. The other type of leader is exactly the opposite. They want to do everything themselves. What I find with that type is A, they burn out. B, when they finally hit the wall, because remember, you're going against the best lawyers in the world who all went to Yale and Harvard and know exactly what they're doing, and they're battle-hardened and they know what they're doing. But eventually you're going to hit a wall. And if you're the leader who wants to do everything himself, when you hit that wall, you're going to look around, no one's going to be there because they'll have all abandoned you because you didn't give them enough opportunities to participate. The third type of leader is one who, the one that Cameron hates the worst, is the one who doesn't have a plan, can't come up with a plan, doesn't really know what they're doing, has kind of wound up here by them on because of politics, or they knew the judge. And those people make a mess of things. I mean, they just do. That's kind of what I've learned, particularly in Avandia, where, in case your viewers are not knowledgeable, I was a lead counsel and we settled over, and everyone has to please excuse me, I've had a series of strokes and sometimes words come hard to me. But we settled over 60,000 cases. We battled it for over 3 years and we settled without ever trying a bellwether case, which to my knowledge is the only time that any MDL has ever been settled completely without a bellwether trial.
Yeah, it's amazing. So I wanted to ask a bit, because I think that this is a question in the mind of lawyers getting into mass tort, is case acquisition costs. And I know that things have really changed a lot in more recent times with different companies that are doing lead generation and private money going into that side of it. So with case acquisition, those costs going up and up, how do you effectively evaluate the profitability of a mass tort campaign before going all in with, you know, the kinds of expenses that you need to do so?
Jason, as I worked my way up through the industry, I started as a receptionist, then became a case manager, then an intake manager, and now I manage the mass tort department here at RBA. When I was an intake manager, I was working at Vance's office for him and Amy as their intake manager. And I came up with this idea of what I call a pick list, projected injury category list. And before every case, I get into that because that addresses settlements as well. So we'll take a slight step back, short little discussion about how settlements may work. Usually there is a lot of objectivity that has to be put into place for your settlements. You have to score injuries. You have to score ages when the injury occurred. You have to score confounders and how much they take away from what your client's case is worth. And there are programs that are starting to do this, especially in PI. You're starting to see this with some programs being used through AI. We have to do that with no knowledge of what it ultimately is going to be. So you say, okay, well, Bobby had exposure for 20 years and he was 46 years old when he developed the cancer, and he worked professionally in the industry rather than having home use exposure. If we were to use a pesticide exposure type case. So you establish what you believe each of the points should be worth at the end of the case to get to values that might make sense for your clients. And so once you have established those, then you can start setting your criteria points based on what you believe that those values should be. You also got to go find a trustworthy company that acquires cases. Sometimes you pay more, because paying more for your cases oftentimes, and I shouldn't say paying more for your cases, because we do not buy cases. I want to be very clear. We are not buying cases. We are advertising, and people are choosing to come to us. There are companies out there that will charge you less, but you have to worry about, is my case getting double sold? Are they doing it through a lead generation that sends that lead to six different intake companies? Is it that I am being told the complete truth by this intake company, or is some of the people that they employ being paid based on the number of cases that they sign up per day? Companies like that, you can't trust. Companies like that are the kind of companies that are going to cause you to lose 40, 50% of the people that you sign up. So paying more ahead of time to people that you can trust, people who are straightforward with you and say, I don't know how much you're going to pay me per case. I have a general idea. I think it's going to be about this. Here's what we're going to put into our advertising budget. Here's what you're going to pay me in fees for me managing the intake for you. Those are the kind of companies that I put value in. Those are the kind of companies that I believe in. Now, to be fair, even with those companies, you need to walk into this expecting a 25 to 30% fall off rate. Client had the wrong product, had the wrong cancer. They die halfway through and their kids don't want to continue to participate. All of these are things that from the very beginning, from the time that you first sign a case to the time that you get to settlement, walk into it with the expectation and set your budget accordingly, that you're walking into it with the expectation of losing 30% of the cases that you sign.
One of the things I'd like to add to that, first of all, I want to be very clear that I'm retired. I'm not in this business anymore. And that's why we're relying on Cameron for all this up-to-date information. However, a dear friend of mine who's still in the business tells me the amount of money that's swamping the market right now from big money funds is just astounding. And what this friend of mine is predicting is that you're going to have more and more bad cases flooding the market. And you're going to have more and more warehouse firms that are not interested in litigation and simply want to hang on to what they've got. And out of a desire to save money, will not work those cases up. So the average value of the case may seem to be less, but if you have a strong population of well-worked cases, they're still going to be valuable. However, changes are coming because this just can't go on. It's not sustainable. There's just too much money flooding the market. And everyone needs to think about that when they decide whether or not they want to get into this business.
So I know, switching gears, scientific evidence is very important in a lot of these cases. And there's been changes in the way some of this is approached by the courts. I'm wondering if maybe we should talk a little bit about Daubert and preemption and those sorts of things, or should we maybe wait and see if we've got some extra time at the end to hit that?
These are the three deadliest snakes in the forest are causation, Daubert, and preemption. Because any one of those snakes bites you, that's a fatal bite. On the other hand, they're endlessly complex, difficult, and they require a special expertise that your viewers may not be interested in right now. But just know this. Those are the big three, causation, Daubert, and preemption. And you have to be familiar with them, at least that to the extent that you know that any one of those three can knock your entire MDL out of the market. There are certain things that are not deadly. For example, statutes. Well, the deal on statutes is that every statute case, the statute of limitations case, it wasn't filed timely, is an individual factual determination. And you have tens and tens and tens of thousands of individuals whose facts would have to be considered and individually litigated. So we don't worry so much about statutes. I'm not saying you should ignore them, but you should realize that they will not kill your litigation. Just know that.
Not always. And I actually want to step in here too. We talked earlier about aggregation and about a judge who wants a case versus a judge who doesn't want a case. When a judge doesn't want a case, you will see wide sweeping decisions on statute. The judge will come in and say, there's no way that you didn't know that this product hurt you at the time that you were hurt. I don't care who you are, what state you're in, any of those facts. I'm going to apply. We're in the JCCP. I'm going to apply California law and only California law. And you should have known, you know, and since you didn't, you're out. That happens. And when that happens, that goes back to that, hey, we got to go find somewhere else to go play. Like we can't do this here. We got to go find someone else's backyard to go have this fight in. And so we have seen it even recently in some cases where a MDL judge gets their hands on it. And remember, these are federal judges, unlimited power, appointed for life. If they don't want to deal with you, there is nothing you can do about it. So I just wanted to state that, yes, statutes are they're malleable. You can use other states in some circumstances. Other states will let you borrow their discovery rules if you are filing in their state. So there are ways around the dead end that may be the 1 year no discovery Louisiana type statute versus the New Jersey statute that says if you're filing in New Jersey, you can borrow our discovery rule.
I'd like to pause for just a moment to say this about my son. Of all of the people with whom I've been involved with in mass starts, Cameron is the most proficient, the most accomplished, and the most knowledgeable, particularly about matters involving politics, judges, and jurisdictions. Cameron understands intuitively and at the most extensive level what is involved. And I've always been pleased and happy to have him by my side, even though I'm now on the sidelines.
But I will state one thing. I'm not a lawyer. Anything that I'm saying, do not take as legal advice. I am not a lawyer. So
all right. In doing my prep for the podcast, one of the things that struck me was the idea that bellwether trials can be a double-edged sword. And if you could talk a little bit about that and why that is and how that plays into all of the strategy for these cases.
It is my opinion that bellwethers are always a double-edged sword and that they always have outside effects. The plaintiff wins a bellwether trial and every plaintiff lawyer in America says, I could have done that. And every client of every lawyer in America says, see, I told you I was worth it because they won $1 million. So now every client says, well, I could win $1 million. On the other hand, the defense wins a verdict, and now the defense lawyer has a problem because that guy he answers to at the company is saying, well, you should win all of them. I told you that. We didn't do this. It wasn't our fault. Why can't you get us out of all of these? So bellwether trials are never helpful in the long run. What is more interesting, I think, is that there are different attitudes about bellwether trials. In the old days, people would rush to file cases because from the securities litigation, class action litigation, they developed a theory that the leaders should be picked from the ones who filed the first cases or the most cases. And what that led to, and I think Cameron is really big on this, is that it led to filing crappy cases in bad jurisdictions by people who simply wanted to be noticed by the court. The second thing, and therefore, one theory is that bellwethers should be picked FIFO, first in, FIFO, first out. So those that are filed first should be tried first. That's one theory. The next theory is that the defense should pick the bellwether cases. Why? And my argument always was, well, all we've done is we've proven you can lose a case. What good does that do us? So what judges do here usually is they let each side pick some. I'm going to pick some, he's going to pick some, and then the court's going to pick some. That's probably the worst possible, but that happens a lot. My theory was always, and this actually worked on occasion, is I would argue to the court, you should let the plaintiff pick all the cases. Right? The defense picked the cases. They win all of them. We've learned nothing. But why not let the plaintiff pick the cases? And then we'll find out if we can win a good case, not a bad case. Let's see what happens when we put good cases up. Then we can argue about what's a good case, what's a bad case. But if we can't win a case, if they can get us out on Daubert or preemption or something, well, then we've learned a lot. And if I do try a good case, at least we know what the values of the good cases are. So between those four different methods of selecting bellwethers, there's a lot of politics. There's a lot of angling but amongst the law firms. And ultimately, it's up to the court to pick what the court feels will help address the litigation.
And I would like to add to that, which is bellwethers themselves, the trial itself is important for that client. So for that particular client, that trial is important. But how is it important for the whole litigation? It's not the trial itself that's important for the whole litigation. It's the headline. It's the jury awards $2 billion, even though that gets reduced severely once it goes up through the appellate court, right? But that headline drives the stock value down. And when the stock value drops, that's when the investors start calling the board and saying, what are you doing? Why is this case still out here? Why is this eating us up? And that's when you get someone who dedicates, you know, again, certain pesticide manufacturers dedicating $14 billion, $15, $16 billion, whatever it may be at this point, to settle all of their cases. And they're still getting hammered, right? This is public record. When Bayer bought Monsanto, they were worth $163 billion. This litigation of Roundup against Bayer, throughout the course of this litigation, Bayer has gone from a company worth $163 billion that, if I looked at the market cap today, it is somewhere roughly around $25 billion. They have lost $140 billion of value because of this litigation. That is what drives settlement. It just ultimately is. You know, everybody knows the McDonald's story, right? Everybody knows the McDonald's coffee story. And nobody knows the truth that at the end of the day, she got about $50,000. Everybody thinks she got $3 million or $13 million or whatever the story may be in your hometown. But ultimately, she probably ended up with about $50,000 but the headline was that she was awarded this much money by the jury, which then was reduced, so on and so forth. Same idea applies here. The headline is what matters to drive the settlement.
You know, Karen, I've always said at the top of these big corporations, there's a guy sitting behind a door, and he's got a guy sitting right outside that door. And when the guy comes, the doorkeeper comes in, the big guy says to the doorkeeper, your job is to keep that door closed. Don't let anyone in here. I don't want to hear it. I want to read my new Wall Street Journal. I'm trying to run a business here. One day, your job is to get that door watcher to knock on the door. And the guy said, what are you doing? What are you doing in here? And he said, boss, we got a problem. Well, then the boss says, we'll go fix a problem. And the guy says, no, it's not that easy. This is a big problem. Could cost us billions of dollars. And the boss says, go spend it. I don't care. And close the door on the way out. Unless and until you can get that guy who's the president of that company behind that door to let the doorkeeper in and tell him that, boss, we got a big problem, then you're not going to be successful. On the other hand, if you ever get to that point where he does walk in and tells the boss, we got to pay these boys to get them off our tail, well, that's when all of a sudden your clients' lives are going to change. You know, I spoke yesterday. I have a habit of giving my clients my cell number. My number is out there. There are a lot of clients. I had a client call me and say, I just wanted to thank you, Mr. Andrus. Thank you for changing my life, for helping my wife and I through this terrible time we've had with this condition, and I'm very happy. The day that you get that call, that's the day that you know you've done well.
That's a good segue to settlements, because I wanted to ask you about the way these cases are resolved, because I know from being in this space that there's been this trend towards trying to negotiate with individual law firms and their universe of cases versus global settlements. And I'm curious about the practical and ethical challenges firms face in dealing with the different ways that these cases can be resolved.
Let's start with this proposition. In a class action, for example, every class action settlement is a global settlement. That is, there is one criteria. All the people might get paid different amounts of money, but there's one set of criteria by which we will determine the, call it, for lack of a better word, the points awarded to a client. And then we look at those points and we see what the value of a point is. And then that's what we award people. So therefore, in that case, your rose and my rose are both the same rose. In a population settlement or an inventory settlement, there's one big pot of money which is given to a law firm to buy the piece. That law firm then has the responsibility to treat every client, not equally, but every client be treated fairly. So you have to design a very intricate system of allocation of points for various, for the amount of use, the injuries, the ultimate outcome, and so forth. And so clients are then, through objective criteria, there are allocated points which converts to dollars that the client can accept. Keep in mind that in our business, the client ultimately controls whether or not the client settles. Not you, not the court. The client can choose to settle or not settle. Now, what that doesn't include, for example, is subjective criteria. So it is not that she was in the hospital 14 days, but she was burned over 40% of her body, and that was extremely painful, as opposed to the next person who was in the hospital for 14 days with a broken leg. How are you going to do that? So what we learned is you set aside a certain percentage of the money and you put it in a special fund for special circumstances where people can apply to get additional compensation. But the vast majority of the funds are allocated on an objective basis to the clients by what they present. The biggest problem that I've seen is you call up Mrs. Smith and you say, well, Mrs. Smith, congratulations. It looks like under this settlement, you would get X dollars because you had one surgery and it was successful. And Mrs. Smith says, oh, I had a second surgery. And you say, wait, you didn't tell me that? That didn't seem important to you? No, I had a second surgery. And then sure enough, she did have a second surgery, only she just didn't happen to mention it to you. You have to have some small reservoir of funds available for those kinds of issues and those kind of mistakes so that you can, because once you allocate the money, you can't change your allocation. And there'll be this client that says, well, if you could get me $10,000 more, I would sign it. And you have to say, well, I'm sorry, ma'am, but I can't, period. That's a hard conversation, but it's one that has to happen under this system. I hope that helps explain that system.
So in terms of resolving cases, how should law firms prepare operationally and ethically to deal with participation thresholds, lien resolution, and deliver what is a very clear disbursement to the client that they understand when the case starts?
I'm going to have Cameron answer that. But first, I want to simply address this issue of participation thresholds. What Jason is referring to there is two different things. There are certain defendants who will demand that we'll give you this amount of money, but 90% of your clients must participate in the process and or accept the settlement that they're offered. The second, and that's to protect them from you giving all the money to your niece. All right, the second thing is they will say, well, we're going to give you this amount of money, but we need 99% of all the surgery cases. We need 87% of these cases. We need 50% of those cases so that they feel like they're getting their money's worth. The rest of your question deals with the ethical and physical requirements to do an allocation system under a settlement. Cameron?
For that, I also will just piggyback off of the participation real quick. If you have prepared your clients, you will get the participation. In my most recent settlement, we had 99.9% participation, and I'm still working on the last two people kind of thing. I mean, it is unequivocally important to prepare your clients, lower their expectations from the beginning. Every client that I talk to, whatever number you think your case is worth, it's worth less from the very beginning. And I tell them that often throughout the course of litigation. And that trouble client that you got, that your case manager or your paralegal comes in and says, I got to deal with Bobby Smith again. Okay, let me deal with Bobby this time. And you deal with Bobby and you tell Bobby, Bobby, here's what's going to happen. And be honest with him. While many clients are ignorant about what we do, they are not ignorant people. They are masters in whatever they do, right? So they have hired us to take care of their plumbing, basically. You hire a plumber to deal with your plumbing. You don't hire an electrician. So they've hired us to take care of that. So if we've prepared them and if we've done what we're supposed to do, then they're going to participate. Now, the lien resolution, sometimes you can do that in-house. If it's a very small one, sometimes you can do that in-house. But in all reality, you need to send that out to somebody the vast majority of the time. You need to find a company that is going to go out and talk to the lien providers and talk to Medicare and talk to Medicaid and make sure that your client doesn't have a lien. Because the last thing that you want to do is find out 2 years after you've paid your client that a $250,000 lien was missed, especially if it's an ERISA lien or something along those lines. Because
Medicare Advantage.
Yeah.
Medicare Advantage, they'll Medicare come after Advantage. You for double.
and that, Jason, you know more about that than I do. So, but
yeah.
I look at it and I say, and then disbursement. You're going to have your funds set up in a qualified settlement fund. Don't put those funds in your own trust. You're talking tens of millions of dollars. That does not need to be in your local individual small trust. It needs to be in a qualified settlement fund with a company that specializes in qualified settlement funds, who is going to make sure that your money does not disappear, that it doesn't get invested in the wrong place, that something bad doesn't happen to it. And then for disbursement, again, be clear about everything. If you say, I charged all my clients $250 for this, for mailings and for paper and for everything else, well, you better check all of your contracts and make sure that that's allowed in all of your contracts. If you charge all of your clients interest on any expenses that you held for them, that better be in every single contract that you have. So when we build our settlements, we look and we say, okay, did our contract allow for it? Did our contract not allow for it? And if our contract didn't allow for it, when we're putting together our spreadsheets and we're putting together our disbursement statements, we note that and we put it in, and that goes out to the client. And that also goes back to the deal with ethics and morals, which is this. We have a ethical responsibility, which is a legal responsibility, to deal with things for our clients. But we also have a moral responsibility to deal with things for our clients. Sometimes your client isn't going to get quite what they need, right? In my opinion, we have a moral responsibility to look at what our fees look like, what our expenses look like. Who are we paying to take care of their liens? Is there something that we can do there, right? Because clients' liens are where they get hit usually very unexpectedly. And so our moral responsibility, even though we don't have an ethical responsibility on it, is sometimes to say, what can I do to help this client get what they need?
Jason, I see that we're just about out of time. So I'd like to finish up with one thought, which is this. There is never, ever, never enough money in the world to compensate the clients we represent in mass torts for every single thing they suffered. There just isn't. So I nonetheless feel justified in what we're doing, because we have done the best we can for the most number of people. I hate to call them victims. You'll never hear me say that. These people are not victims. They were injured through the negligent or intentional acts of bad actors. They're not victims. And we have done the best we could for them to fairly try to compensate them as best we can, given the legal and financial facts on the ground. And I leave this conversation and I leave this business where I practiced law for 57 years, secure in the knowledge that I did the best that I could.
Well, if you guys have a little bit of time, there's two more questions I wanted to ask before we wrapped up. One was just about what you believe AI and technology platforms and some of these different funding structures are going to fundamentally change about the mass tort practice in the next 5 years?
Vance and I were actually discussing this a little bit. AI has come so far already, and the things that we don't know about, you know, always know what you don't know. And the things that we don't know about, the things that are inside of Google right now, the things that are inside of Microsoft right now that have not been released are far and away, you know, we are going to have trouble imagining what they are capable of doing. However, AI is a fantastic tool that can also make fantastic mistakes. We see this continuously with people trying to write their briefing and their motion practice using AI. You have to put eyes on it. It may reduce our staffing some. It may make life a bit easier, but the mistakes are going to be bigger and the judges are going to hold us to higher standards. So we will have a responsibility. And my thought on it is what you will see in our industry is the people who learn by rote, the people who get good grades because they do the work and all of these things, and just because they struggle through, but they get there. Those people are going to have more trouble succeeding in our industry. The people who are going to be fantastically successful are the ones who take the intuitive leaps. They look at a document and they say something is wrong with this. I don't know what it is. I don't specifically know what it is, but as soon as I look at it, I know that there's something wrong with it. Those people are going to be the ones that are going to be looking at their AI printed up motion practice and say something's wrong with it. And then they're going to go grab the kid who learns by rote and who understands how to fix something. And that's the person who's going to be fixing it for them.
So last question, I'm curious about any mass tort areas you are watching closely right now and whether there's any industries, products, or harms that you think are ripe for litigation but have not been developed yet.
I think the big industry that's coming up obviously is climate change, but it's not representing individual people. It's going to be representing communities, the same way that opioids was about representing communities and not the individuals. It's going to be about building levees in Florida and in Mississippi to stop the floodwaters as they rise. And then you're going to have to figure out, and Vance will, I'm sure, be better about addressing this. Who do you sue? Because there's 100 different, you know, 1,000 different companies and industries that are responsible for those, for that. So I think that's really over the next 5 years, 10 years, that's one that we're going to see a lot of. Right now, I'm heavily involved in the PowerPort litigation. I really believe in it. I think that there were some serious kind of fake gold, right? Fool's gold, because the PowerPorts are technically the gold standard for long-term medication treatment, but I think it was a real fool's gold situation.
My only response is this. If you want to know what's going on, call Cameron, because his daddy is retired and probably needs a nap.
Well, that's probably as good a place as any to stop. So thank you both for joining me. If anyone has questions, Vance, knowing that you're retired, Cameron, what's the best way for them to get in touch with you if they've got questions about anything you guys have talked about in the podcast episode today?
Sure. So I'm always happy to answer any questions. If anybody wants to email me, I'm happy to even give them my cell phone number once they email me. My email is Andrus, that is A-N-D-R-U-S, at rbatort.com. So Roman Balaban and Associates is RBA. That's the best way to contact me. I did want to say one last thing, which is we made this sound incredibly difficult, which it is, but it is also incredibly rewarding. You get to help a lot of people. You get to fight the biggest of the bads. This isn't Bobby got into a car accident and hurt your client by accident. This is intentional, directed assault upon your client that these companies are conducting. Vance has told me my entire life, if someone poisoned my food, my water, or my air, they would be in prison. We say that companies are people as far as politics are concerned, that money is freedom of speech, but we don't put the people in charge in prison when they're killing people. So this isn't about justice. It's about restitution. It's about fighting the good fight.
Great way to close out the episode. Thanks for that. And thank you, everybody, for tuning in to this episode of Trial Law Review. And we'll see everyone on the next episode.
Thanks.
Thanks, Jason.
Here is another episode of Trial Lawyer View. We hope you enjoy today's guest and discussion. Tune in to our next episode for more helpful insights from fellow trial lawyers and practice experts. This podcast is brought to you by Synergy. Visit partnerwithsynergy.com to learn more about how Synergy can free your firm to focus on what it does best.